The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here with IJ Senior Attorneys Paul Sherman and Bob McNamara. Our discussion today is a continuation of our series on law for non-lawyers, and our topic is precedent. Many of our listeners are probably generally familiar with the concept of precedent, but like so many aspects of the law, there's actually a lot to unpack there. And we thought that the topic was especially timely given the attention that is focused on the U.S. Supreme Court right now and the fact that the Supreme Court is in many ways the final arbiter of precedent. So, Bob, when people see senators grilling judicial nominees about precedent and their opinions on it, what are they talking about?
So the basic idea of precedent is just that we should decide cases in the same way we've decided earlier cases, and that similar cases should come out similarly. If you have the same facts, you should have the same outcome. But what we're actually talking about when we talk about precedent in the American system is not quite the same thing. It's not just the idea that similar cases should come out similarly, but is also wrapped up in the idea of how the court has actually described its opinions. Because it used to be the case that if you had an appellate court with several appellate judges, they would issue what are called seriatim opinions. And so if you go back and read early U.S. Supreme Court cases like Chisholm v. Georgia, every single justice has an opinion. And it's just kind of the justice explaining his vote. I think Chisholm should be able to sue Georgia. I think Chisholm shouldn't be able to sue Georgia. I think it's very important that we look to how other countries deal with this. Under no circumstances do I think we should look to how other countries deal with this, because all that matters is the United States Constitution. And at the end of it, you just have to kind of count up the opinions, and whoever got more votes is the one that wins, and that's the judgment of the court. And so what that tells us about precedent is the next time Chisholm sues Georgia, Chisholm should win. But what does it tell us about Maryland? What does it tell us about why Chisholm won? And Chisholm did win and was eventually overturned by the 11th Amendment. But the kind of innovation that Chief Justice John Marshall brought to the court is to say, hey, guys, we should stop doing this. Nobody knows what we mean. Nobody knows what the law is. Instead of all of us kind of getting up on the bench and one by one saying what we think, we should just agree on what we think and issue a single opinion that is the opinion of the court. And the Chief Justice didn't invent the idea of an opinion of the court. Those had happened before. What he invented was the idea that every time, every case, should have, if we can get five votes together, that or a majority together, however many are on the court, if we can get a majority of the court together, we should say this is the opinion of the court, and this is the explanation of why the opinion came out this way, and this opinion will tell you what facts matter in kind of getting to that outcome, and that will tell you what the law is, and that will be your guide to deciding future cases. And that's really the American innovation that we're talking about when we talk about precedent in our legal system.
So, Paul, how do concurrences, dissents, you know, the idea that you have, okay, the opinion of the court, this is what people think, but obviously the justices still don't always agree. They still have their different opinions about, you know, the American Constitution versus other countries. How do courts look at those? You know, how does that play into the future way that you look at similar kinds of cases?
Sure. So it really depends on a lot on what the majority opinion says and how the majority is formed. So on the U.S. Supreme Court, if there's a clear majority for a particular outcome and then concurrences in addition to that, the concurrences don't really add much in terms of precedential effect. They just sort of give that justice's view on how the case should have been resolved, maybe slightly differently. And of course, dissents don't have precedential effect. They're really written more towards the future so that, you know, someone with the wisdom to recognize how brilliant the dissenter is will adopt that rule of law when they have a chance further on down the road. What can get really complicated is if there's no reasoning that commands a majority of the court and say four justices think the outcome should be X because of one reason, and another justice thinks it should be X for a completely different reason, then there can be real questions about what the actual precedent of the court is. Which one should be binding? Should it be what the concurrence said, or should it be what the plurality of justices said. And that's probably way too deep in the weeds for us to get into in this podcast. But it goes to show that concurrences can have a valuable impact in terms of precedential effect.
No, and it's actually frequently, surprisingly frequently, an important question. And this is a deep dive where I've been given permission to nerd out. And so I'm going to go there. But so what the Supreme Court has said is in that situation, because the court has precedents about precedents, you're supposed to do what's called a Marx analysis, where whichever opinion is the narrowest opinion, that's the one that's supposed to control. And that's the precedent you have to follow in the future, which is the kind of thing that sounds helpful and sounds like it resolves the question and is in practice totally unhelpful. Just as, for example, one case that many listeners are probably familiar with is the McDonald v. City of Chicago case, which incorporated the Second Amendment against the states. And the McDonald case doesn't actually have a majority. Four justices said that under the doctrine of substantive due process, the Second Amendment should be incorporated against the states. Four justices said that under the doctrine of substantive due process, the right shouldn't be incorporated against the state. And then Justice Thomas said the right absolutely applies to the state through the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. And it's very simple to resolve that. The controlling opinion is the one that is narrower. And I have no idea which one of those opinions is narrower. All we know is that the precedent is that the Second Amendment applies to cities and states somehow. We don't know exactly why. And that's where you start to wrestle with what actually is the law that comes out of this opinion.
Yeah, and the Marx test has come under a lot of criticism in recent years. Some of it, I think, is a little unfounded. You know, in the McDonald case, I think I agree with Bob that the holding of that case on which a majority agreed was that the Second Amendment applies to the states. And so we know that it does. Future courts may have to wrestle with which provision it actually applies through, because the scope of the Privileges or Immunities Clause and the scope of the Due Process Clause are not the same. So, you know, this leaves some unresolved questions.
Well, and actually, one of the questions that I had for you is, you know, what kinds of cases set precedent? So is it the case that if you have something like McDonald where there is this uncertainty or this ambiguity, and then you just get another Second Amendment case that becomes the one that's precedential because it's more clear? Or, you know, how does that work?
I think in the case of McDonald versus Chicago, basically Justice Thomas's view has been seen as sort of interesting, but everybody else views it as a substantive due process case. And so lower courts that have looked at it, at least from the opinions I've seen, have not really grappled with, oh, well, is it really substantive due process or is it really the Privileges or Immunities Clause? And they've just sort of treated it as substantive due process. But, you know, that's just one example. You know, there's a lot of different rules for precedent at the U.S. Supreme Court level, because sometimes they take cases and they resolve them without having any argument. And those can have different precedential effects than the decisions that they take up and hear on the merits.
And even beyond kind of what the formal precedential effect of a Supreme Court opinion is, it remains the case that the only thing a precedent really establishes is that this plaintiff on exactly these facts should win over this defendant on exactly these facts. And the world, being enormously complicated, never presents the same facts twice. And so the question becomes, how do we really know? Like, sure, every judge will grant you that similar cases should come out similarly, and we should decide like cases in like manner. But what they don't agree on is what actually makes the cases like. And so all the Supreme Court said in Chicago is that effectively a blanket ban on firearms, that this right applied, and that a blanket ban on firearms violated that right, which tells us in a formal precedential sense next to nothing about what we do with laws that aren't blanket bans, that aren't ordinances passed by municipalities. And figuring out which of those factual differences matter and why they matter is frequently what we're fighting about, more frequently than we're fighting about whether formally an opinion was joined by five justices or only four.
Yeah, I would actually say that that may be the most fundamental skill of lawyering. Like when people talk about going to law school and learning to think like a lawyer, most of what that is being able to look at cases and decide which facts are relevant and which facts are less relevant, and then figuring out how that compares and contrasts with the case that you have before you.
So, you know, in terms of precedent, and how expansively could a court rule? Like if they want to say, you know, you have a judge who is a very big proponent of the Second Amendment and they want, you know, the most protection that is possible to have. I don't know how extreme it could get. How can they do that? Can they, or are they limited by the case that's before them? Or they could say, you know, I'm going to look at these facts and I'm actually going to go a little bit further. And now everybody has to deal with that.
Well, I mean, they can say whatever they want. The question is what future courts are going to respect as actual binding precedent on them. And, you know, speaking as a lawyer, I think there's a very simple rule to figure out how broadly precedent can be read, which is that the cases that are favorable to my position should be read broadly, and the cases that are bad for my position should be read narrowly and applying only to their own facts. And so this is kind of the constant debate. Like, formally, the case should only control as to the holding of the case. Every case has a holding. That's the logic that is necessary to get you from the facts of the case to your final judgment in the case. And that holding is what's binding on future courts. Everything else is what we call dicta. That's just the court expressing its opinion. And so if a judge decides the case in front of him and then appends a 20-page section about how Paul Sherman is a terrible person, he's welcome to do that. But future courts aren't bound to hold that Paul Sherman is a terrible person because that had nothing to do with the case before him. And we do get into a lot of fights about what's actually necessary to get to the holding. On the one hand, there are people who are very willing to distinguish cases based on the facts. It's been widely reported that when Chief Justice Rehnquist was on the bench, he was very willing to sort of advance factual distinctions from prior cases. And Justice Scalia would kind of gently mock him, saying, like, oh, well, that case was about cars, but this case is about trucks. Trucks are a totally different area of the law. But there are also disputes within actual cases about how much justices should be saying. There was a First Amendment case just a few years ago where Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion, and it was a restriction on protesting outside facilities that provided abortions. And the question was whether it survived the First Amendment. And what the chief said was, okay, to decide whether something survives the First Amendment, it could have strict scrutiny, which is really, really high, or it could have intermediate scrutiny, which is kind of in the middle. And so I'm going to describe to you how you choose between strict scrutiny and intermediate scrutiny, and I'm going to say this law gets intermediate scrutiny. And then I'm going to say this law doesn't survive intermediate scrutiny. We're striking it down under that lower standard. And it's very possible to read that opinion and say, wait a minute, what was all that stuff at the beginning? Like, if all you want to say is that this law fails a lower standard of review, you can just say that. You don't need all of that. That's dicta. You didn't need to say any of that. And I think the chief's response would be, no, it's necessary to decide the case to figure out what the standard of review is. And so I did that first. And I don't think that's a debate that actually has a clear and correct answer. It's just kind of the inevitable squabbling over how to write a judicial opinion and how much of the judicial opinion is actually necessary to decide the case in front of you.
Yeah, I think that reveals sort of a real tension in the rule of law concerns that are underneath precedent. You mentioned Justice Scalia a while ago, and I think it was Scalia who had an article. It was called "The Rule of Law is a Law of Rules." And he was really in favor of announcing bright line rules in his decisions. And those rules, because they're bright line, necessarily they're going to go further than the facts of the case that are before him, but they provide a lot more clarity and predictability to other people who are out in the world and who want to figure out, you know, what they can and can't do. You know, on the other hand, that means that, you know, you're going to have a certain amount of imprecision in the way you address issues, because you're not going to have that sort of flexibility to tailor your ruling to the actual facts. And, you know, there's pros and cons to both approaches. And I think that there's no one on the Supreme Court who's perfectly consistent on that. I think they sort of approach it based on what they think the needs of the case are.
So from a practical perspective, Bob, you mentioned earlier, you know, that the right way and the wrong way to look at a precedent depends on what you're trying to persuade the court, you know, with respect to your position. What if you're trying to persuade them on something where the precedent that you're facing is really bad? How do you get from, you know, Plessy v. Ferguson to Brown versus Board of Education? You know, where it's pretty clear and it's really not something that you want to have to live with for any longer than you have to. As a litigator, how do you proceed?
So I think there are really two questions in there, and it depends a little bit on what court you're talking to, because if precedent is bad enough, sometimes the answer actually is to overturn the precedent, to say, look, this was wrong. It was wrong at the time it was decided, and it was wrong because it's inconsistent with the original understanding of the Constitution. Perhaps it's wrong because it's predicated on a bunch of factual assumptions that turn out not to be true. Perhaps it's wrong because, having lived with this rule for so long, we see that it's completely unworkable and it's created a mess in the lower courts. But those are arguments you can really only address to the level of court that set that precedent in the first place. It doesn't do you much good to go to a federal appellate court and say, the U.S. Supreme Court got it wrong. And because what they will say is, maybe so, and what do you expect me to do about it? And so there, you're really left with trying to distinguish the case. And sometimes you do that just by pointing out factual differences, but you can also point out that there are developments in the law. There's such a thing as trends in the law, courts reading rights more broadly or more narrowly. And I think there's a lot of power in talking to lower courts about that in terms of how broadly they're going to read a precedent. That you could read the language in this 50-year-old case to suggest that plaintiffs here lose 100% of the time. That's certainly what it suggests. But there are a bunch of cases that post-date this case where plaintiffs win. And so maybe we shouldn't read that sentence for all it's worth. Maybe that's just dicta. That can't really be the holding of the case, because if that were the holding of the case, all of these later cases would have come out differently. And this is something that comes up frequently in IJ's economic liberty litigation, where there is a whole host of cases saying absolutely terrible things about your right to economic liberty, and how eagerly the courts will uphold laws that infringe on your right to economic liberty. And those cases are out there, and they say what they say, but our response to them is, look, those sentences are bad for us. Those sentences say we should lose 100% of the time, except people don't lose 100% of the time. People actually win. They won cases before those sentences. They won cases after those sentences. And so you can't read those sentences as establishing a rule of law that says I always lose, because we know, just as a matter of observed reality, that I don't always lose. And so that case must stand for something else. Its holding must be narrower than what it says its holding is. And then, once you can kind of sell someone on that basic premise, you can start to talk about what that holding really is, how you go about harmonizing all of these different cases, because all of the cases are precedent, and they all have to be read to give you one coherent rule of law. And that coherent rule of law can't necessarily be drawn from any one cherry-picked sentence. You need sort of the overarching gestalt of the thing to come together into a single form. And that's a lot of what the work of a lawyer is, yep, that's a bad sentence for me, and that's a bad sentence for me. But what you need to do, judge, is distill a rule that says all 15 of these cases make sense. And since in three of those cases, the guy in my shoes won, your rule can't be that the guy in my shoes always loses. Let's talk about something a little more nuanced that explains all these cases.
I think another way that we can approach it, and it's particularly timely given the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is to kind of heighten the contradictions between the old precedent and the new precedent. And that's also something that we do by trying to find sort of wedge cases with really sympathetic facts where judges are going to be willing to exercise whatever leeway they have to rule for our clients. And so when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was leading up the ACLU's project on women's rights, she would find cases, for example, where a widower was denied Social Security benefits that he would have received had he been a widow. And she argued that that's just irrational to distinguish between widowers and widows in that way. And she won that case. And gradually, you build up enough precedent where the courts say, you know what, actually, a lot of these distinctions are irrational. And maybe our default assumption that the government is acting rationally when it draws, in that case, sex-based distinctions, maybe our default assumption is wrong and we're going to change the rule of law. And that's actually what we try to do with our economic liberty work. We think if we can win enough of our economic liberty cases and show to judges that, you know what, actually this presumption that the government is acting in the best interest of consumers and not to protect, say, cartels from competition, you know, maybe eventually courts will say, yeah, that actually seems like that's happening a lot. Maybe a better default rule is a presumption of liberty instead of a presumption of constitutionality.
So the first question is kind of like, what if you're in a lose, you know, a posture that could be perceived as losing? Well, then the flip of that is when we win, and this has happened, you know, at IJ, we've won all the way up to the Supreme Court, and then often continue to litigate either the case that we won, you know, again in lower courts, or additional cases on the same issue. Can you talk a little bit about why that is? Why isn't the fact that, you know, you win at the Supreme Court, there's your precedent, why do you have to keep litigating these kinds of cases?
Well, you know, a Supreme Court decision isn't self-executing. So when the court announces that a particular type of law is unconstitutional, it's not like they hit a button on their computer and it disappears from the statute books all over the country. Some states will still have them on the books and they'll say, well, as long as it's on the books, you know, until our specific law is held unconstitutional, we're going to enforce it. And so sometimes what you have to do, although it's not a big part of our practice, is a little bit of cleanup and go out and make sure that the clearly unconstitutional laws are being struck down. But, you know, another thing is that judges are people, and lower court judges often disagree with rulings of the U.S. Supreme Court. And as we've been discussing, they have a certain amount of leeway to depart from those holdings by trying to find ways that cases are factually distinguishable. So one of the things that we're really concerned about is when we get a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court that protects liberty, we want to make sure that lower courts are implementing that decision in a way that is consistent with liberty. Because if you don't do that, what can happen is that over time, your victory gets whittled away until it really doesn't mean anything.
No, and you can have a victory where you have those wonderful sentences that are in the middle of the opinion that are what the law ought to be. And I think without careful attention and vigilance, those quickly become sentences instead of holdings. And so a lot of what we do is try to make sure that the holdings we secure remain holdings and are read as broadly as they should be and actually enforced. But it's also the case, I mean, that's sort of talking about why we have to continue litigating issues, and we certainly do continue to litigate issues even after we win them at the Supreme Court. I am sometimes asked why we're still litigating about this question when we've already won in the Supreme Court. Like, didn't the Supreme Court already say the government's not allowed to do that? And I say, yes, but nobody told these guys, so I'm still here. But separately, even after we win a case in the Supreme Court, we frequently have to litigate that same case, even if we've established the precedent. And maybe the most prominent example of this in our recent practice is our win in Timms v. Indiana. And in Timms, we won a unanimous victory at the Supreme Court that said the excessive fines clause applies to the states. The states can't issue excessive fines or excessive civil forfeitures, and that's a hugely important victory. That is a precedent, it's a legal rule that's going to protect a lot of people. But it's not a ruling that says our client Tyson Timms gets his car back. It's just a ruling that says what the rule is, and they send it back to the lower courts to apply that rule in the first instance. They say, okay, You can't impose excessive fines or forfeitures. Go figure out if this is one of those. And so we're actually still litigating Tyson's case, although he does have his car back because we won again in the trial court. But that case is currently back before the Indiana Supreme Court because, well, we've established the precedent, sort of the big top line thing that one might want out of a case like that. Ultimately, winning the case requires you to go back down and use that precedent, sometimes even on behalf of the very person who won it in the Supreme Court in the first place.
So last thought on this, as we've talked about sort of the concepts, we've talked about how it works if you're a lawyer. What if you're just, you know, an average person facing some kind of abuse, Supreme Court issues a great decision. It's like, oh, great. You know, they're not allowed to do this to me anymore. Is the only way to vindicate your rights, you know, under precedent, whether it's new or old, to bring a lawsuit? I mean, if you're an ordinary person, how can you ensure that the government stops doing bad things when the court says it's supposed to stop doing bad things?
I mean, sometimes the only way is a lawsuit, is an actual court order directing the government to stop doing the thing. Because all too often, government officials will look at a court opinion and say, nobody told me not to do anything. And we've actually seen this in some of our litigation where we'll win a case in Washington, D.C. and Charleston, South Carolina, which has an identical law, will issue a press statement saying, this doesn't do anything to us. I say, well, okay, I'll come do things to you. But I don't want to be too cynical about it. You don't always need an injunction to make the government change its behavior. And sometimes government bad behavior or government refusal to kind of comply with court directives or with changes in precedent, it really is just a matter of ignorance. Even among lawyers, most lawyers don't track everything that comes out of the Supreme Court. They're not aware of every new decision. And it may be that the people in your town just haven't read a court opinion. And bringing it to their attention, complaining, standing up and waving it around and saying, it seems to me this says you're not allowed to do this to me, sometimes works. You know, the same law that Charleston had where they issued a press statement saying, come and get us, and so IJ had to come and get them, Williamsburg, Virginia had a law exactly like that, and they took a look at what the courts were doing, and actually some local citizens took a look at what the courts were doing and went to the city attorney and said, hey, I think you guys are going to be in trouble if you don't knock this off. And the city, to its credit, took a look at the way the courts were going and said, I think you're right. I think we're going to be in trouble and we're going to knock it off. So it doesn't always have to be a lawsuit, but it does have to be some kind of citizen activism. Because Williamsburg did not, on its own steam, say we're going to canvass the federal courts and check each and every one of our ordinances to see if we're behaving properly. Citizens who were the victims of those ordinances said, hey, I read this court opinion, and it seems like you guys are going to get pasted if someone ever comes to town to stop you. And they, not all cities respond to that, but some cities do, but only if you ask in the first instance.
Well, with that, we are out of time. I have a feeling that this is a conversation we could make go a lot longer, so maybe we'll need a part two. But in the meantime, thank you, Bob and Paul, for joining, and thanks to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed today's show, you can find more on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe.